Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and I have to confess something to you. I really don't like to go to the grocery store. I find it really overwhelming. There are so many choices. Just the milk alone, the almond, the goats, the oats, the cows. And then sometimes when I get in the middle of the store, I think about all those people who can't afford to buy groceries. But then I think, okay, then I'm going to try to buy ethically. And like I said, overwhelmed. Now, some people love to go to the grocery store and go grocery shopping. No matter how you feel, the grocery store is part of Americans' life. It's estimated that the average adult spends 2% of their life there. And in 2018 alone, Americans spent $701 billion in supermarket grocery stores. So how much do you know about how that box of pasta or that head of lettuce got there? Author Benjamin Lohr knows a lot. For his new book, The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket, he spent 5 years researching the different corners of our national food supply, from the inside of a chicken processing plant to the long-haul truckers who are essential to moving food around the country quickly, to the people who fill the shelves at your local supermarket and pluck that lobster from the tank at the fish counter. He was one of them for several months. The New York Times calls the book a deeply curious and even-handed report on our national appetites. Benjamin Lohr, welcome to All of It.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
From your book, you know, we get a sense that there's quite a bit of opaqueness about the grocery business. How did it affect your plans to write your book?
How did I get the plans to write the book? I think I've always loved the grocery store, but it has a... You know, there's an almost hallucinogenic quality to being in there, and I think I was fascinated with that. And it's not just like the literal hallucinogenic of saturated colors, but this contradiction between feeling relaxed and calmed and soothed by just kind of strolling down those aisles with the wax floors, and then at the same time feeling this immense power kind of radiating from the volume of choice and abundance. And that contradiction is something I've always been drawn to and fascinated by. I go to grocery stores in other countries, but it's something that I felt like if you scratched that veneer, you'd get something pretty interesting. And as a writer, that's what I'm after.
All right. That just stressed me out, your description. Different
strokes. Not the intention.
So grocery stores should be a source of pride for New Yorkers. The idea of the first supermarket sprung up in Queens. So how different is a supermarket that we go into now from that first King Cullen in Queens?
Oh, well, the supermarket today from the first King Cullen in Queens in 1930 is not that different. Essentially, we just inflated Michael Cullen's original idea and kept making it gradually bigger and bigger. His store was probably about 9,000 square feet, maybe smaller. And now, you know, you have Costco's that are 200,000 square feet. What's interesting is just how different Michael Cullen's store, the first supermarket, was from what preceded it. Prior to Cullen, supermarkets there was nothing like that. There was something called the general store, which was, you know, part hardware store. They might have some drugs in little like vials, you know, patent medicine. There might have some dried fruit in barrels, some grains, but very little fresh fruit. And people got their food from, you know, a butcher, this general store, and a variety of other markets. And really, over the course of about 60 years, all of that changed with the development of packaging and brand identity into the store that we have today. Right? At the general store, you weren't allowed to touch goods. They were all behind the counter, and a clerk kind of maintained them. They were all sold in generic bulk. And then as the cardboard box gets invented, tin cans come of age, the technology there comes of age, and all of these individual products need labels on them. So all of a sudden they become individuated, and all of a sudden customers just, you know, want to reach out and touch them. And then they want to sift and choose between them. And so that shopping really changes format from just going to get something to an act that has meaning in it. When you make that choice, it can be a choice to, you know, show love to a child that you're buying something fancy for, or a husband, or express your frugality and your ability to be a smart shopper. And all of that really came of age. And Cullen realized this and created the modern grocery store by, one, allowing customers to touch items and put them out front. And he was following the footsteps of Clarence Saunders, a grocery innovator before him, in doing that, but also by then volumizing the store and making that choice, that adding abundance to that choice, so that price really fell down, and he kind of created like a circus-like experience for the shopper, which we now take for granted, right? And now it's this chore, or in your case, it sounds like a kind of a threatening chore. But at the time, this abundance was fascinating, and all he did to advertise his first supermarket was list out the prices of the goods he was selling in full sheet-long advertisements in the paper, and people just lost their minds at this like kind of carnival of food that he was offering.
My guest is Benjamin Lohr. The name of his book is The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Market. So that title makes me have several questions. One, why is it a dark miracle? And are supermarkets uniquely American? Is there something about them?
Oh, yeah. So supermarkets, American as jazz and the T-shirt and maybe the cell phone. You know, it's like a quintessential American invention. Like I said, prior to Clarence Saunders and Michael Cullen, there really wasn't anything like it. And when the first American supermarket opens outside of America, it's in Italy in the mid-1950s, 1956, people go crazy for it. The Italian shoppers, you know, at the first ribbon cutting, started running up and down the aisles yelling, "This must be heaven." And, you know, reporters are describing them as stunned and goggled-eyed and shrieking. And I think that surprise is something that we've obviously lost, and that quality of just how amazing it is. And that's why I think the moniker Miracle in the subtitle is appropriate. On the flip side, that miracle comes with considerable cost. And, you know, as the book progresses, we get deeper into the supply chain and places that are less visible, and not just less visible to us as consumers, but actually less visible to the buyers at the grocery store who are sourcing their products. And in the places with less visibility, things can get quite dark.
Your research led you to the Thai shrimping industry for this book. How much variation? First of all, can you describe it for us?
Well, not succinctly. So the Thai seafood industry in general, Thai shrimp in particular, is incredibly convoluted. I think I walked into this book with this image of like a corporate flow chart where you'd be like, importer, exporter, manufacturer, right? And it's kind of just neat little lines on a wall that I could follow. And it's not like that at all in reality. The volume that the supermarket is processing, so all supermarkets are kind of predicated on this idea of continuously offering this abundance and choice. And so the volume that it takes to keep that continuity up, to feed our appetites, is so tremendous that it takes sourcing it in ways that involve aggregators at every level. The like lines are much less straight and narrow like pipelines, but thickets of interlaced suppliers, and especially in shrimp, where you can raise them in one place and then transfer them pretty easily to another place for processing. Where the food, so shrimp are carnivorous, so even though they're being farmed largely, or at least the ones I looked at in the book, and in Thailand they're almost exclusively farmed, they still take natural inputs from the ocean. They require protein, fish protein, and so sourcing that to feed the shrimp, it's a 2-to-1 ratio. You need much more wild fish to produce the shrimp. That becomes its own supply hurdles with with its own intricacies. And so there is really no simple way to encapsulate the supply, the Thai seafood industry, except for to say it's massive, interlocking, and at its very fringes, it's defined by smallholder fishermen and small boat operators. And so it's very democratized and spread out, and that lets good actors and bad actors coexist along each other in a way that is very frustrating for a consumer who wants like simple, absolute moral choices in front of them. That doesn't exist in that world, at least right now. You have upstanding people operating right next to people who are doing absolutely some of the most horrendous things you can imagine, right down to human bondage, slavery, murder, and exploitation of the worst type.
Trying to get a new product onto a grocery store shelf is an I had a friend who tried this. It's incredibly difficult. And in 2015, you met Julie Busha, the creator of, Slossa?
Slossa. Combination coleslaw and salsa.
I have a clip of her actually pitching it on Shark Tank. So let's take a listen to Julie Busha pitching Slossa, and we'll talk about it on the other side.
Tell me, when was the last time you were at a grilling or tailgating event and someone actually complimented the host or hostess on their condiments? Well, it probably never happened because, let's face it, traditional condiments are boring and they haven't changed in decades. But what if I said I had the condiment that will change your lives? Introducing Slossa, a unique cross between a slaw and a salsa. It's great on your grilling fare, like your hot dogs, brats, burgers. Use it as a sandwich spread or even as a dip for tortilla chips. Right now, I'd like for you all to taste Slossa and how truly slawsome it is.
Slawsome, the best part of the whole pitch.
He's slawsome.
What did you want to learn? What did you want to find out by following someone who's trying to break into the grocery world with a new specialty product?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I just had no idea. I think like you, I kind of walked around like, oh, I'd make a good guacamole. If I took the time out of my life, I could put it in a jar and make millions. And it would be pretty straightforward. And it's just not. One, it taught me so much about how the supermarket operates. I think I had a naive perspective in that if I was to sell my guacamole or Julie selling her salsa, her biggest competitors would be the other condiments on the shelf. But that's not actually true. The supermarket makes a great deal of money off the products themselves, off by which I mean by selling space, kind of like a landlord in the store. So Julie is constantly being hit up for offers of giving the free product or opportunities to buy shelf space or 2-for-1 deals that she has to foot the bill for, all of which just juice the bottom line for the grocer. And so, you know, and beyond that, there's just the amount of work that she did. And Julie is, you know, absolutely one of the most thoughtful, hardworking people I've ever met. And to see that passion being poured into her baby, this product that it was fascinating to see up front, and completely disabused me of the notion that I could do this with something I created.
Yeah, my friend who had a product had that shelf space issue and found it incredibly frustrating to try as an independent person to get shelf space in a supermarket.
Yeah, it's changed the game in a big way. You know, all of grocery is kind of being subjected to the market, but the costs have kind of risen steadily, and it forces young entrepreneurs to get venture capital to kind of play with the big boys, and it just raises the risk. Instead of being able to kind of premiere your product slowly, build an audience, and then go national, you're forced to take out loans, and it creates a much harder game to play, and certainly squeezes out a lot of good products that we as consumers would probably enjoy, but they just can't get their act together to play with the big guys.
My guest is Benjamin Lohr. The name of his book is The Secret Life of Groceries, A Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. You write about the founder of Trader Joe's, and you stress you're not a huge fan of Trader Joe's. I'm going to say this is not a commercial for Trader Joe's. But what did Joe Colombe understand that his counterparts in traditional grocery stores did not?
Yeah. So I walked in not such a fan of Trader Joe's. I like it. It's great. You know, I just don't think I'm a member of the Trader Joe's cult, but I left a true fan of Joe Kalum, who is the founder. He was a visionary, and he really defined Trader Joe's in opposition to a lot of what we've been talking about. And he did so really early. Trader Joe's was founded in the mid 60s, and he actually started in groceries at convenience stores in the mid 50s. And what he did is he shrunk his offerings down to a human scale. So if we're talking about these 200,000 square foot Costco's with, you know, or and Walmart's with 100,000 different individual products, and you're a supermarket buyer, so you have a category of your own, and you might have 70 categories with 15,000 different products you're supposed to be master of and choosing the best ones to get on shelf. It's an overwhelming thing, and it results in a system where buyers become more of just replenishers and just putting things on shelves, and food becomes just a product. And he won just through the kind of humanistic observation of what people were interested in, and seeing the fact that there was big trends in education and travel, the GI Bill. He decided people are going to want more individual products where they can stretch their intellect, and I'm going to empower my buyers to do that by shrinking my offerings down, kind of going in the direct opposite direction that everyone else in the industry was doing. And so Trader Joe's has a much smaller selection, but those selections exist on their own, distinct from the market. And this was very true in Trader Joe's day and Joe Kalum's day. Of course, it's been somewhat diluted in the present, but I think his DNA and kind of essential blueprint is still there.
Last question for you. Because of the pandemic, we saw shortages of food. We've seen outbreaks at meat processing plants. We've heard about long-haul truckers having to deal with closed rest stops. Given all your research, what's something that you notice that the rest of us wouldn't notice, the way the pandemic has affected grocery stores?
Oh, well, I mean, I think it's something that we all know. The pandemic, one of the big messages of the pandemic is that existing inequity is getting accelerated. So if you are already in an inequitous position, the pandemic has made it worse. And so I think that's extremely true for the grocery store. It's pushing things. It's less customer facing. You know, now there are dark stores that exist to serve kind of online. And those non-customer-facing places are going to be even more ripe for the type of abuse that we haven't even talked about on this show, but that exists in the retail world in general, because they're not even beholden to customers who are expecting the employees to smile.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's something.
The name of the book is The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. Benjamin Lohr, thank you so much for sharing your reporting.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on here.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.